This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community. Here's another Saturday Magazine podcast brought to you by Joy sponsor, Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Across Melbourne on Joy 94.9 and streaming online at joy.org.au, you're listening to Saturday Magazine, every Saturday, 10 till 12.
Greg Dillon's the Executive Officer of the Yarra Drug and Health Reform. The reason we've asked Greg on the show this morning is because we're very interested in a report that was tabled in Parliament, in Victorian Parliament this week, on drug law reform. This is an area that's been really very, very busy, and there's been quite a lot of commentary on this, but this report sort of appeared almost out of nowhere by an obscure committee called the Law Reform Road and Community Safety Committee. Good morning, Greg.
Hi, good morning, how are you?
Good, thank you. Great to have you on the show this morning on this long weekend here in Melbourne. Greg, this committee is a parliamentary committee. I presume it's a bipartisan committee.
That's right, yes. It's an upper house committee and it's made up of members of, various parties. And so you've got Greens, you've got, the Liberal Party. So you've got the Reason Party as well with Fiona Patten. So
yes.
quite a mixed group. Yeah.
So without going into the specific recommendations, can you just give us a sort of a flavour of where the report's going? Because my reading of your media release and what I've heard in the press is that this is recommending quite a shift in the way in which we deal with drug policy in this state. Can you just give us an overview of that, please?
The committee's report, it took quite a while for it to reach, the point where it made its recommendations. It's been meeting and discussing these issues for well over 12 months. And, there was a lot of interest in terms of what the committee might produce in terms of a report. And they travelled overseas quite extensively, and they went to Europe and North America and had a good look around and saw what was happening internationally around drug policy reform. The interesting part of that was that there was a senior police officer, Assistant Commissioner Nugent, who also attended with the committee. And, they came back and the report was written up. And it makes quite a number of recommendations, as you say, regarding drug policy reform, which the study tour reflected that. So it has been greatly anticipated. I know in terms of the Yarra Drug and Health Forum, we submitted we put in a report to them and we actually spoke to that committee. So there are a number of submissions, I think over 200 submissions.
Wow.
And significant number, and nearly 50, I think it was 49 recommendations. So, pretty big report, obviously, when it was handed down in Parliament earlier last week. And, it was quite a milestone, really.
So Greg, what I'm reading in the report is that there is an attempt to try to shift the debate from a law and order framework into a health and harm reduction framework. Is that the sort of the correct framing of it?
It certainly is. And I think if you've been working in this area for quite some time, which I have, you would have seen a shift over the last probably 10 years.
Oh, Greg, I think we've lost you. Yes, we have lost you. So I think we'll have to ask Paul to call him back again. But, for those who are unfamiliar with the report, what it actually does talk about is essentially adopting much more progressive approaches, which don't criminalise drug use, but rather treat them as a health issue. And the example that's being sort of put forward is the Portugal drug decriminalisation model. I don't know a lot about that, so I'm interested in learning about that. Jenna, do you know much about that?
No, not that particular model, but the issues generally, you know, have been kicking around for a while, and they're very important in terms of trying to move us forward away from a place where we criminalise people with essentially a health issue.
Greg, it's Tass here again, and Jen and I were just reflecting on the Portugal drug decriminalisation model. What can you tell us about that?
Sorry, I dropped out for a moment. In terms of the Portugal model, the Portugal model, I guess, is the decriminalisation model that's widely discussed and held up. It's been operating there since about 2001, and it's been extensively researched. And what they decided in 2001 was that effectively the war on drugs wasn't working, and the focus on particularly policing and the courts and the prison system really was. It was also draining the money from the government. So they decriminalised all drug use, which means every type of drug use is decriminalised. So if you're apprehended or found by the police and you're using a drug, you go before a what they call a dissuasion committee, and that committee has a range of options in terms of what they can do. And by far the majority of people that go before the dissuasion committee, they get is basically a caution about the potential risks in terms of illicit drug use. So it's very much a health and harm reduction focus. So they provide information about, you know, what would happen if you continue to use, well, for example, cannabis or heroin or methamphetamines and the potential risks there. If you continue...
Does that include cannabis as well, Greg?
Yes, that's right. It includes everything.
Because there are specific recommendations about decriminalising cannabis in the report itself, from what I see.
Yeah, it makes a lot of recommendations about exploring issues, and certainly one of those is cannabis. And, you know, we have had, a decriminalisation model that's been running in South Australia for quite some time, which is an expiation notice system where if you get caught with a small amount of cannabis, a specified amount, you get what they call an expiation notice, which is a civil penalty. If you pay that on time, there's no criminal record kept. Because one of the major harms that's been identified, and particularly from people such as Professor David Nutt in the UK, he's classified all drugs according to harm, and he rates cannabis number 10 out of, I don't know how many drugs there are, but it's a long way from number one, which is alcohol and tobacco. He's rated at number 10 because even he said that he put it at number 10, but it should be actually lower than that, because the greatest harm that happens for someone who's caught with cannabis use is actually being apprehended by the police and getting a record. That's the major harm from cannabis use. So
Greg, I'm going to be a bit provocative here, but what about all those all that discussion about the relationship and the links between psychotic behaviour and psychotic responses to cannabis use? How do you sort of include that in the equation around this discussion?
Look, that's an interesting and it's a really important discussion. And look, for some people, a small and very, very small number of people in the community, certainly the effects of cannabis can be quite risky, but certainly people who have a predisposition towards certain psychotic conditions, they are at risk. But a lot of those people are already using cannabis anyway because they self-medicate with cannabis, particularly young people. And so they've got, an added risk with that in terms of being apprehended by the police and getting a criminal record, which severely impacts your life. And we know that, for example, the criminal justice system and policing for many, many people isn't a deterrent anyway. So why have a law which, frankly, many police don't want to implement anyway, they don't want to enforce it, it increases risk and doesn't stop or prevent harm, particularly in terms of mental health. So, you know, when we talk about cannabis and decriminalisation, even legalisation, you know, we're looking at, I guess, the evidence, which suggests that the current system isn't working.
So, Greg, one of the other recommendations I see is around the establishment of on-site drug testing units to test substances in composition and then release public alerts, particularly at drug testing at festivals and other events.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about that and how it might work? It sounds like an issue that might be interesting to explore.
Yeah, certainly. As far as drug testing is concerned, it happens a lot overseas, particularly in Europe. And again, this is reflected in the study tour that the reform group visited. Netherlands and England, UK, Denmark, etc., all conduct drug testing at festivals. So in those situations, a person can give over a sample or a drug, ecstasy tablet or whatever, to a tester, and they take samples from that drug. And a lot of the time, unfortunately, the people that are using the drug is destroyed. But what they do is they analyse on the spot using a gas chromatograph the contents of that particular pill, and they analyse it and they determine exactly what's in that that particular substance. So they then issue a caution to the people that provided that particular drug to say, look, you know, in your particular drug, we found this, this and this, which can be particularly harmful or risky. PMA, for example, is a very, very toxic form of amphetamine. So, and that's the one which has caused a lot of concern, a lot of harms in dance festival, music festivals, etc. So,
just wondering.
Basically,
I was just wondering how that works with the patterns that we see with young people using drugs at festivals, because I know I was involved in the dance part, the also parties through the 90s, and and there was a greater tolerance, I think, of the policing of some of those substances. And whereas now we see, it's not unusual to see dogs at dog squad at festivals and those sorts of events. So we're seeing young people taking all of their drugs before the event.
And
potentially overdosing, whereas I think in the past we saw a bit more... I think maybe it was less understanding, really, but there was a bit less regulation, I think, of how people were using those drugs in those times, and I think it was probably a bit less harmful. Could you introduce something like drug testing at the festivals and other events without all of the other package of reforms that you're talking about?
Look, you certainly could, and it wouldn't be difficult for the police to support pill testing. They support needle and syringe programs now. They're going to support the new supervised injecting facility, which is being established in North Richmond. Now, it's not difficult for police to set up a local policy around, not targeting or not going near a drug testing event. I think you could easily introduce a drug testing program into festivals, etc. In the near future, they're looking at that in Canberra, for example. It's not difficult to do. It's just about people's willingness and motivation to do it. These things are pretty straightforward to run. They're not difficult, but it's about whether people are actually motivated. We've invested a lot in the so-called war on drugs through policing, through courts, through prisons. And often it's about what drugs represent. It's not actually what they are. And if you look at the investment that we've had, governments have invested over the last 15 years, which, as you pointed out earlier, as we talked about earlier, it's really swung towards, heavy law enforcement, a war on drugs approach, more drug dogs, more powers for police, greater visible police presence. If you look at, for example, the introduction of drug testing for drivers,
yes,
that's another example of ways in which, I guess, policing has focused very much on drug use, particularly that public view of the way in which drugs is seen. And police have really focused on drug users. They're really hitting drug users hard. And despite, former police officers such as Ken Lay saying we can't arrest our way out of it, we are still determined to do that. We still have very, very high rates of arrests for drug use.
Yes, we do.
And we do. And I know it's...
Greg, right. I'm going to have to cut you off there because we actually have run out of time, unfortunately. But this is clearly a topic that we can talk about for a long time, and perhaps at some point in the next, few weeks or so, we might actually ask you to come into the studio for a much longer conversation about this, especially when we know what state government's planning to do with this report and some of these recommendations.
Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, proudly sponsored by Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.